Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the Full Tank Motorcycle Podcast with me, Rob, from the YouTube channel Motorbob, and I'm joined, as always, by my good friend, Tim. How's it going, mate?
It's going well. I said to you just before this, I'm a little bit tired because I did the flat track experience day yesterday, but because of that, I am buzzing, so it's a good kind of tired.
Did you enjoy the metal boot?
Yeah, I did enjoy it when I was walking to the bathroom because you do, it just changed your gait somewhat when you're strutting around. And also running around with the camera as well, which is obviously something you have to do if you're filming. You have to sort of run a quarter mile quite often. Mate, it was a game changer though, actually, because you go out the sort of first time without one and then they stick you in a boot and then you actually get to just drag your foot the whole track. And it absolutely changes the game. It probably gives you a little bit too much false confidence that like, oh, I can pick this bike up because your foot's down. Your brain sort of reroutes to, oh, well, I'm just static and I can just lift it if it falls too far. But obviously you couldn't. It would just go on the floor. But yeah, good.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. You feel like you can just pick it up and then you realize you probably can't squat an entire Himalayan with one leg.
Yeah.
Is it the Himalayans?
Yeah, it was. Scram 411 Himalayan, same sort of thing. But
got you.
Yeah, it, like lightly modified. I think they've just kind of like changed the wheels and maybe done tweak the engine and given it an absolutely banging exhaust. I don't know whether you took the same away from it as I did, right? I've never, ever heard a Himalayan sound as good as it does with that S&C exhaust, I think it is, they've got on there. But it actually makes
that.
A single cylinder sound great. Yeah, and it's a fine bike. It's okay. But like, I've never thought it sounds good. It's never been its strong point, but actually they sound good on that day.
That is probably the most pronounced example of a, you know, an aftermarket exhaust transforming the sense of speed. Like it's a very slow bike, 20 horsepower, but you feel like you're going fast.
Yeah, and you're also probably doing like 10 mile an hour around a circuit, like a circle. Yeah, and you're like, oh my God, this feels like 90. Yeah, it's one of the most useful experience days you could do because you get used to controlling a slide and that gives you more confidence elsewhere riding. So I'd recommend it to anyone
who
can.
I was in the same boat as you where I was trying to film the day and I was self-shooting. Yeah. And also trying to enjoy it and trying to take on some of the teaching and stuff like that. And so I think I'd love to go and just do it without the work side of things. But I definitely know what you mean. It's one of those things I'd advise as like a off-road skills building thing that isn't just taking a big adventure bike straight off-road.
Yeah.
Also, it's got to be said, that boot is a prime candidate for the most medieval piece of motorcycle clothing I've ever seen.
It instantly sounded. Yeah, no, not really. No, it instantly sounded like people were walking around in a suit of armor. Yeah, like you just
it's
sort
got
of
a Game of Thrones vibe to it.
Fully, yeah. I want a full leg. If they could do a full, I don't think it's called a gauntlet, but whatever you'd put on your legs. Just one, just the left side, just in case.
Well, I'll look forward to seeing the video, I guess, over on Urban Rider.
Yes.
Anyway, we're going to rattle through some of the best motorcycle news stories in the biz today, as well as get stuck into some comments of the week, and also have a little peek at a rather tasty-looking bike of the week as well. But first up, we've got a new bike from Livewire, and it's called the S2 Mulholland. This came out a couple of weeks back, and basically, you know, it's their take on like an electric cruiser. So it's a cruiser interpretation of the S2 Del Mar that they launched, I think, last year. Have you had a look at it?
Yeah, I mean, visually, lovely. Mulholland's a place in California, is it as well? Is that where they sort of get the name from, derived from?
Not I guess
that's at all relevant. I'm just trying to sort of flex. I know California and America.
Your geographic knowledge. Well done, mate.
It's limited to that. It does look really nice. A lot lower than the previous Livewire. It's kind of, what would they call it? Where they sort of just slammed, I'd say, slammed on the rear almost.
Yeah, it's lower at the back than perhaps the S2 Del Mar. I feel like the Mulholland, it's sort of slightly unusual looking in the way that they've obviously given it a much longer fork to make it cruiser style, but then they've stuck with fairly small, sporty looking wheels. Personally, I find it like a little bit of an odd looking bike, the Mulholland.
Between the two, the Del Mar definitely catches my eye a bit more, yeah.
But, you know, you got to appreciate there's some design work gone into the individual parts here, and it is, of all the electric bikes and electric cruisers, let's say, you know, you can see there's some quality gone into the design. It's a bit of a funny one though, mate, because I guess they're trying to make something that's a little bit closer to Harley's core audience. Harley, of course, started the whole Livewire thing. It was their big push into electric. Then they sort of realized that maybe the Harley core audience wasn't really interested in electric, so they separated out the two brands. Mm. But now Livewire's launched more of a cruiser-style bike, but I'm still not sure it's realistically going to sell, and it's probably not helped by the fact that there have been some recalls on the Del Mar. I don't know if you saw about this, but basically they said they've got some, in quotes, software issues, and then when you look into it, some of the bikes have, I think the problem is that they can potentially just shut down the whole electric drivetrain without any notice. So I think there was a recall. And that is probably why, I think we mentioned this a few episodes back, that we were meant to have a S2 Del Mar press bike and it still hasn't shown up. It's been quite a few months now. So
that was,
yeah, it's been a while.
Okay.
Hopefully, you know, I mean, all manufacturers are prone to recalls. That one sounds particularly alarming, though, if you're on the motorway or something.
Yes.
But hopefully they've worked out those niggles, let's call them. But still,
It seems more severe than sort of like, right, so I don't know, I think you've run out of petrol. I definitely have on more than one occasion, right? And when you run out of petrol...
I haven't, but I don't want to tempt fate.
All right. When you run out of petrol, actually, the Ducati did this to me where it just cut out in general. But
the new one?
No. Don't you jinx me either. The scrambler that I had. So I was on the motorway, or just about to join onto there, sort of 50 miles an hour, and it did, it just cut out. But at least the sort of one get out that you've got is if you clutch in, coasting, you know, freewheeling, at least you can maintain speed. If an electric motor decides just to stop, the drag is quite severe. So I'd imagine you'd slow down even faster than if you were in a petrol bike and say you run out of fuel or whatever, where you can coast and just pull in the clutch. So yeah, it becomes more dramatic. Like you say, if you're on the motorway, you've got even less time to get over to the hard shoulder, which is a concern.
You just have to Fred Flintstone it as quick as you can.
Yeah,
get the feet
speed
down,
legs,
get pedaling. Yeah, it sounds a little bit alarming, but I don't know, even if they do dial out some of the software issues, in quotes, I'm still not sure if I see these massively selling. And it seems to be a thought reflected on Ride Apart, which is where we pick up some of these news stories. I found a great article called Should Harley Give Up on Electric Motorcycles? And they sort of outline the timeline of the Livewire brand. Now, I fully recommend going and giving it a read. We'll put links in the descriptions to all the stories we discussed today. But here's like a brief overview. They launched the initial Livewire. Did you ride that first Harley Livewire?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, $30,000 it was at launch. Quite a lot of money. Mm. I mean, what you could get all sorts for that. A fully stacked out GS or an MV Agusta.
Yeah.
Something really fancy. And so you had to really want one, I guess. Didn't sell particularly well, I don't believe, at launch. So they dropped the price. It came down to about $20,000. And I think it was equivalent in the UK. I think it was nearly 30 grand in pounds. And then down to around the 20 mark at that point. That was when they were like, it's not really selling. Mm. We don't think it's a Harley brand. So they split them out. So you have a separate Livewire brand, separate website, I think a slightly different presence in dealers. Mm. And Harley didn't really have an electric, if you will. And then these S2 models came in with the Del Mar, but it still cost 16 grand at launch, $16,000. And that's still realistically too high, especially considering they had to downspec it quite a bit. So it's really more so considered a city bike. So it had less power, less range, and all of the marketing materials and the launch that they did in Barcelona were really focused on city riding. Mm. And so now you're thinking, okay, the price has come down another 4,000, but really the capabilities that they are marketing this bike on are now quite limited. Mm-hmm. That's where we're at now. We've got this S2 Mulholland and it's still, you know, pricey, but again, with that city focus. And the context of all this that they report on is that they saw operating losses. Q1 this year was $29 million lost on the back of 2023's $125 million losses and $85 million of losses in 2022. And so it's like, at what point do you just say, this ain't working?
Dollar one for me. I mean, I can't afford those kind of losses. Woo! It's a strange one. I know we shouldn't relate to the car industry too much, but we do. It sort of strays in. They are at least connected. And the car industry seems to, theirs is really taking off. And it's maybe it's still relatively sort of slow to adopt, but you've the hybrid makes that a bit easier because you've got like a soft transition into it. And with cars, there's a very clear push globally that it has to meet these requirements, and that eventually we're going to move away from combustion engines, as it stands at least. But with bikes, it's you're playing a really long game of very high risk because there's no guarantee that this is ever going to really work, you know, or that people are going to adopt it or take it on. So, goddamn,
and it feels a bit like hard. The strategy's not that clear because they were moving away from the cruiser and Harley image.
Yeah,
now they're going back towards it.
Yeah,
ooh, I don't know, mate. I don't see it, to be honest. I think I don't see this as the bike to save Harley's electric ambitions.
Would you like to be in those board meeting rooms? Just not involved, not like you've got to give a presentation, but just to see, just to feel the tension in the room. Would you like to be as part? Like,
how's 2024 going so far? Not great. Look, you know, you always hope that brands succeed and find a way, I think, as a business. So hopefully they do turn it around. But yeah, I still think the price has got to come down. And that's tricky because they're not selling in big numbers, which is obviously one of the ways to bring the price down. But moving swiftly on, mate, one area in which I do think that electrics make a lot of sense, again, this is something I've talked about before on the pod, is off-road and sort of trials. It's quiet, clean, they're torquey, the range doesn't really matter so much. And also the off-road trials bikes that I've ridden are lightweight and maneuverable, and you don't really suffer with all that weight of a massive battery that's trying to give them kind of like road levels of range. And Triumph are now offering their adventure experience on the Osset bikes, which are their sort of, like I say, electric little trials bikes. Triumph actually bought Osset, which was a British electric bike manufacturer, a year or two back. So it seems like a really cool way to sort of combine the two brands and show how they can work together. And I think, you know, it's interesting, we were just talking about the flat tracking, because for me, having done this Inch Perfect up north, they use the EM bikes that used to be called Electric Motion. I'd say this is one of the most valuable ways to start off-roading. So this is definitely one to give a try. I think, what were you saying the best initial off-roading experiences you had were? Probably the flat tracking now, but didn't you also do a day on smaller dirt bikes?
Yes, I did the Mick Exton's experience up in North Wales near Snowdon, or around Snowdon, and we were on Honda CRF 250s, so yeah, it was a good first introduction, yeah.
I think what I would say, mate, if you're thinking about trying to get into big bike adventure off-road riding, two things I recommend straight away are these electric trials bike days. So Inch Perfect, the Triumph Adventure experience now with the Ossets. It's just low stakes. The speeds are lower.
Yeah.
The bikes are lighter. The bikes are like built for going over and being quite robust. And they give you a really good sense of like picking lines. It's not really hardcore trail riding where they're going to have you jumping off big rocks and barrels and stuff. although they did have like a play area at the Inch Perfect day. It's more about, you know, going up rocky little climbs, and we did a bit of riding through streams and stuff like that. And so that's a great way, like I say, with relatively low stakes, and they can provide all the gear as well to wear when you're riding, to just get into like looking at where you're riding, looking at the obstacles, looking ahead.
Yeah.
Plotting a route and that kind of thing. And then the other one, I think you're right, is the flat track day, where you get comfortable with the sensation of the bike going sideways. And the best way to start that is with a metal shoe on and a 20 horsepower bike that's not going to spit you off.
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas a big adventure bike could easily get spinning up and
And what
check
was great off. About the flat track as well is that you are going right. It's literally just a corner, a corner, a corner. So every single corner, you're getting a little bit better, a little bit better, and you're just going closer. You can sort of millimeter, inch, millimeter. Get my metrics mixed up.
Yeah, inch but
you can, you can inch closer to, you know, the perfect corner, if you like, that you'll never achieve. But it's just good. That's how you improve. It's just doing it over and over, repetition. And I think what I sort of see these as is, yeah, I would say those are two of the quickest, biggest changes you can get or improvements in your riding. But I think they're all viable and useful. You can take pieces of it and use that. And one of the things I think the trials riding is going to give you is just your balance and control and your core strength as well, right? So if you can do that you know, as much as you can. But if you just get to do it once, then it will definitely teach you things that you can absolutely apply to other areas of your riding. It's great.
I think that's it. Yeah, like getting some of those skills and abilities, then possibly moving up to something like the CRF day you did, or the Himalayan day that we did, where the bikes are getting more adventure-y, but they're still relatively modest in terms of power and weight. And then I'd probably move up to like a big bike adventure day. This is in a dream scenario where you've got loads of money, so you can do loads of experience days.
But maybe one a year or something, you know?
Yeah, I'd try something like the Honda one we did on the Africa Twins was fantastic. Yeah. The Triumph Adventure Experience I've not been to, but I believe it's great as well. And sort of build up. But that's how I'd progress, like I say, in an ideal world with money, no object. Another interesting development as well from a different manufacturer, Royal Enfield, is that they now are offering the ability to rent Enfield bikes with their dealers over like a big network. So 60 destinations across 25 countries, including but not limited to India, France and Indonesia. But they're all compiled now on the Royal Enfield website. So if you search for Royal Enfield rental and tours, you can see this section of their site where you can just put in a destination and when you want to go. And it's going to give you all the options across their dealer network of like where you can rent and hire bikes. Now, I think this is super cool because I once went out to India and Nepal for some work thing before I was full-time on YouTube, and I had a couple of days off to acclimatize, so I thought, well, I better rent a bike and do some riding over there. But it was a little bit tricky, you know. I had to do a lot of research in terms of finding something I trusted where I thought I'd get a decent bike and with a decent guide as well. And I had to do a lot of TripAdvisor checks to look for reviews and looking on their Facebook pages. And it still felt a little bit of a leap. And even with that, mate, you know, the guide on my Delhi ride, we'll put some footage on the screen now because it's way, way back on the channel when I used to just vlog trips and stuff, you know, still had me at his mate's shop trying to sell me stuff and things like that. Okay. And it was great. It was really good. But it was like a bit of a, like I say, a leap of faith. And it was still, it wasn't entirely immersed in motorcycling, which is what I really wanted. This, however, you know, if you're working with Royal Enfield dealers, you're going to a real biking destination, presumably. And also they've got the stamp of like the Royal Enfield brand. Presumably they do a little bit of a quality check to make sure you get on there. But I think it sounds quite cool, doesn't it? Like an interesting way to, it's a good way to start if you think, I'd love to go to this country and do a bit of biking. I think it gives you a starting point now, a foothold.
Exactly. And I think it just making it easier for yourself. And, you know, obviously we've had the chance to go on press launches and stuff. It's so nice to be in a new place, exploring, and to get all of the kind of obstacles taken out of the way for you, like it would be if you obviously you're going through a company, a well-established company like that as well, where they're just going to set it up for you. So yeah, it'd be really fun. It's and again, I would recommend that to anyone, especially when you've got, like you say, it's not like Airbnb for bikes. There's no sort of gamble. You're going to end up with a professional experience.
If you could choose any Enfield bike and any country to do a tour on, what's your dream?
Do you know what I really liked the look of was the Himalayan in the Himalayas. It did look really fun to me, I have to say. Because, you know, the road riding I can kind of get over here. I would want something that I can't get or experience over here, and I think that might be it. How about you?
Well, having done a little bit of riding on the Bullet, I would have appreciated something with a bit more punch, but it was still like a very cool experience. But also riding in Delhi and then in Kathmandu, both the tour companies were saying the ride you really want to do is up to the Himalayas. You like come back and do a week or something. They said it's like unparalleled in terms of breathtaking views and then also some challenging riding. So I think I'd agree that would be pretty amazing. And in fact, that was the launch trip for the Himalayan 450, but I couldn't do it because it was a whole week. So I turned that one down. In fact, though, the Himalayan 450 has just shown up, the press bike for review, which we're working on at the moment. I thought I'd just touch upon what I like about it so far. I mean, you know that I wasn't particularly enamored by the previous gen Himalayan. I think I've mentioned that on the pod, surely.
Yeah, it's probably come up, yes.
Have you had a go yet? Because Urban Rider Deal. Enfields.
Yeah, we've got. I've seen them rolling in. They have turned up, and I will be swinging a leg very soon. But no, not as yet.
Really good, honestly. Like compared to the previous gen, it's just like night and day. Such a big step up. Much more power. Much more interesting to ride for that. Great TFT display. I think the styling looks good. The finish, level of finish looks great as well. Lots of nice little details like the integrated rear tail lights and indicators. And actually, it's got me thinking, it's like the most off-roady mid-capacity adventure bike. And so if you want something that's a real all-rounder, you know, stuff like the NX500 from Honda that we both rode a few weeks back.
Yeah.
It's a road bike, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Whereas this does feel like it's got the off-road ability and it's taken a bit of a step up on the road because of the extra power and stuff. So definitely have a go on one, mate, when you get a chance.
Yeah.
And that would absolutely be my pick of the Enfield bikes to hire from now on. It's the most powerful, apart from the 650 Twins.
Yeah, okay.
The most powerful single. Mm. And has like a quite a nice spec on it. Mm. And it's still got the charm, though, of the old Himalayan, and
yeah,
so very enjoyable. My other job for today as well is to take back the MT-09, which I've just been riding for a couple of weeks as well. Quite sad about that.
Yeah,
it
can
is
tell.
Fantastic, mate.
Edited that one for you.
You edited that one last week, didn't you?
And
you said,
so I got to hear your love for that bike. It's great, because I take on your opinion as I'm editing it, because obviously you're just, you know, on repeat, just listening to the your review go through. I think I would agree with you. It seems like a great bike, and if it's improved from the previous version. The only real flaw I had with the previous version was the suspension was a bit soft and it was maybe a bit tall, so I didn't really trust the feel of it, if you like. I wasn't getting as much feedback as I would like from, say, a Ducati Monster or a Triumph Street Triple or whatever.
What about the SP? Did you try that?
I didn't try the SP, no. So I tried the MT-10 SP. And loved that one. And the MT-09 I tried was the standard version. So, yeah, quite softly sprung.
I think they firmed it up this year on the fork. That's one of the specific changes that they've made. I think they've changed the steering angle as well. But, yeah, more support on the front. But it's the riding position that's the one big thing. I mean, there's lots of little tweaks. Sure. The TFT dash is much better. It's a bit bigger. Switch gear have been totally redesigned. Much better. But it was the riding position that I always found was a little bit weird. It was on such big risers, the bar, that you felt quite sat up, and it was almost like an adventure-y position.
Yes.
But then on a road bike, it sort of feels off-road riding position, but on a sporty. So you're thinking like Supermoto or something like that.
Yes.
Now it's much more, it's not as aggressive as like a street triple where you're up and over the bars and tail up a bit, but it's like a very neutral balance. It's like a bike that you feel you could ride every single day, but with this ridiculous fun factor. And I think the price is decent as well. So sad to give it back. Mm. Picking up the Tenere 700 Explore, though, and bringing that back today. It's raining at the moment, so that's going to be 2 hours each way of pure misery.
Of exploration. Yeah. Yeah. A wonderful day for it.
Hopefully it dries up later. And then we've also got the 990 Duke on the way soon, which is another bike I'm very excited about. And it'll be interesting to see how that compares to the MT. Look, one piece of news that's just going to make its way into the running order here that just popped up yesterday is that BMW have just announced their own automated shift assistant, ASA. The reason I think it's kind of interesting, and I just want to throw it in here, is because it's almost exactly the thing we were talking about in the last episode with Yamaha's patent on the MT-07, where they were talking about using an electronic actuator on the clutch and gearbox, so that if you wanted, you could have it in an automatic mode where it takes control of the clutch and takes control of the shifts, a little bit like DCT from Honda, but technically simpler. Or you could stick it back into a manual mode where you make the shifts with your foot and that actuator switches off. But I think the clutch is always going to be electronic. I don't think there's a clutch lever that you can fall back on. Surprising, mate. I don't really understand where all these things... It seems like we talked to... When we did the tour of the MV Agusta factory, they were talking about implementing something similar. Yamaha have patented something. Honda have brought out their e-clutch. BMW have now brought out this, you know, it's a halfway house probably between Honda's e-clutch and Honda's DCT.
Sure.
But it's like, who's asking for this? It's crazy, isn't it? I haven't spoken to anyone who says the clutch is the problem.
I guess my thought on this is whether or not it's an arms race that you just sort of get sucked into where you don't want to be left behind. Whereas if you see, say, Honda or Yamaha doing something and you go, but if we don't have it, customers aren't going to buy our bike because they'll be able to go, well, you get extra with us. You get this as well as an extra sort of package. Or maybe they just know something we don't, because I'm sure there are countless instances in sort of the development of bikes and cars where no one's asked for it it's arrived, and then they go, oh yeah, couldn't live without it. Like, it might, maybe this is a development that for the future people just will expect.
I think you might be on point there, because I think I've mentioned before on the pod that when I spoke to some of the staff at Honda on some of the launch trips I've been on, they were saying, and I do believe I've said this before, but it's important for this, bikes that are available with DCT, Goldwing, XADV, NC750, Africa Twin, on average across the board, they sell more bikes with DCT than without. And so although people aren't necessarily crying out for it in the comments of YouTube videos and stuff like that, actually the sales figures possibly suggest that this is quite a lucrative thing and also opens up bikes to like a certain market. So maybe BMW are looking at that and thinking, we've got to get involved. In the press release, I think I'm going to try and get a full video out on the main channel, mate. But in the press release, they say that it can also potentially tie into stuff like active cruise control. So you really don't have to do anything anymore. It'll do the gears.
That's dangerous. You could fall asleep on the bike. I don't want that. I think the weird thing, though, I would say with the Hondas, having bought an older Africa Twin, is they cost more with the DCT gearbox because there's more goes into it, right, initially.
It's about $1,000, I think, isn't it? Extra for DCT.
But the resale value, I think from when I was looking, the manuals were actually getting a better price because there were less of them, I think, from when I was looking.
Interesting. So you didn't get your money back?
Yeah. So I don't know, because if they're so commonplace, but if that's the more common version, it makes the other one less common, therefore sort of ups its price a little bit. But interesting thing.
Perhaps your hoity-toity biker who is buying a brand new Honda wants it, but you salt the earth used bikes biker like yourself, mate, is not interested.
That's true.
And wants like a manual box.
That's true.
Anyway, we'll see how that one pans out. Definitely be a bike we're looking to get hold of, like a GS or a big tourer like the RT with that system. Definitely want to try out and see if it enhances the riding experience. But I do think a lot of people will be like, no thanks to active cruise and shifting gears on your behalf. All it needs to do then is steer, and you truly can clock off on the motorway.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think it's time to dive in to some of the comments of the week. I've pulled out a few here, mate. A few little looseness just to get us in there. FR99763 says, did you guys get a discount on your glasses?
I wish.
We said this before we started recording the last episode, didn't we? That if I have my hat off, I've got less hair on top of my head. We're both wearing the glasses. And then with the beard, it's a similar tone, slightly lighter now with just a few grays in there than to your hair. And we were talking about the daddy's ketchup bottle where if you turn it upside down, it makes it makes the same face, just one with the beard and a bald head. And
someone
one with a bald chin.
Yeah, Rob's beard onto my face. And then Neil, full top and tail, bookend.
That would be a very luscious, complete set of hair on the head there. Yajurpant6141 says, is it only me or does Tim look quite similar to Lorenzo Savadori? We've had quite a few Tim lookalike suggestions over the past few weeks. I think we started courting them, to be fair.
I don't like that this has become a thing.
Do you rate that one, mate?
Hell of a compliment.
I would say so.
I mean, I rate it as like, thanks very much. I don't know if I see it necessarily. Similar hair. I feel like we've got the sort of, I think they call it like a pompadour hair.
I would say there are certain photos of him where you don't look similar, but there are some with certain facial expressions and angles where I'm like, I do see that. So I'll give that a 5 out of 10 rating. Some truth in it.
Wowza. Thank you. I saw one a while back. Didn't someone comment that you looked like Eddie Hall? That's one I saw.
What?
Yeah, no, genuinely. My mum goes through the comments as well. Shout out, mum. And she clocked one somewhere that I think they said you look like Eddie Hall. I was like, oh, wow, that's a really strong.
I hope that's in his sort of powerlifting. I hope that's in his more recent lean phase than his just chunked out powerlifting
face. I take it as a compliment, mate. They're saying you look like you can lift.
I also like the idea of he has like a bit of a Mohican haircut, doesn't he? Which if I had enough follicles down the center strip there, I'd grow one. But things are a little lean up there nowadays, so I'll stick with the hat and the the short crop. Anyway, in the last episode, we were talking about the fact that the GSX 8R, sporty, fared version, I think from our observations and just talking to people, seems to be selling a bit better than the 8S, which was the naked. And so a few people threw their theories and hypotheses into the ring here in the comments on the last video. So here are three takes on it. The Geordie Monkey says, I think the weather has possibly played some part in the fared versus unfared sales. Last year, for most, was utter crap for sunshine, constant storms, bleeding into this year, which is absolutely true. It's been pretty horrendous.
Yeah.
And people have had enough of freezing to death and constant soakings. And I think folk are opting for comfort and weather protection more. And if the weather's poor, you're still likely to get out a bit with more comfort. So that's potentially one reason. And I think because these sports bikes, like the Daytona, the GSX 8R, those sorts of things are a little bit less aggressive in the riding position. There's perhaps less of a trade-off versus a naked, where let's talk like MT-07 versus R7. You're going quite aggressive, and so you're sacrificing a lot of riding position comfort to get the fairing. But because I think the clip-on style bars on some of these newer sports bikes are sat up a bit, maybe it doesn't feel like such a reach down. Which would you go for, given the current weather? Do you think that would be a factor for you?
Do you know what? Actually, probably, yeah. Having had a bike with full fairing and kind of going back to the naked version, yeah, there is a lot to be said for it. You really don't necessarily think it does that much. And look, bad weather's bad weather. You're still in bad weather, even if you've got a fully fared bike.
Yes.
But you really notice it when you go backwards.
Totally. Yeah. RX20 says also, the 8R's fairing looks so much better than the cheap-looking Insecty 8S. Could be another factor, and I think I'd agree with that.
Yeah.
The 8S is like slightly unusual proportions at the front, and also maybe down at the bottom as well, where there's a bit of a gap behind the rear wheel, whereas the 8R, generally with the fairing, looks quite cohesive. It's almost like they designed the 8R and then took off the fairing and tried to make the 8S work visually. Rage Rider 6283 says, thanks for covering my comment in the last video. No problem. Appreciate the comments. Essentially, the 8R looks better, so he also agrees, and it can do everything the 8S can and more while retaining similar comfort. So that's the comment on the bars. And I think that is true. You probably feel a bit more comfortable taking the 8R to the track, something like that. Maybe a bit of touring to tuck in behind the screen. But also, effectively underneath, you've got the same bike. Excellent comments. Love the insights. Please do leave comments on this one on the YouTube version as well, and we'll pick out some other bangers for next time. And that leaves us with Bike of the Week. Mate, have a look at this one and tell me what you think while I describe it to our audio listeners. And this is an XSR 900, which I think is one of my favourite, well, certainly the GP version with the fairing, half fairing and clip-on bars. One of my favorite looking bikes for 2024. We got one coming in June, so I'll do a full review on the main channel. Hopefully it's as good to ride as it does look. And this particular kit showed up on Visor Down, so we'll link to their article in the description below. But effectively, it takes the, you can get the Yamaha racer kit, which gives you fairing lowers and a proper exhaust and a tail tidy. But this is on a website in Japan called Wise Gear or YS Gear as a sort of aftermarket part. It's not a Yamaha accessory. And they've got some technical stuff like a steering damper and a few other parts. But the thing that I love on this, mate, is this sticker pack. Apparently inspired by things like the TZs and YZRs, proper old school retro Yamahas. But I'd be very, very tempted to fit one of these, wouldn't you, if I had a XSR 900 GP?
Yeah, no, I think I would. It does elevate it somewhat. I mean, it's a subtle sort of change, but there's a lot to be said for nostalgia. It instantly hits you in the feels, and that's really, really cool. I like this colorway. Yeah, it's very evocative.
Which is your pick of the two? There's a red one, and then there's one that's like blue, white, red. Black.
It's going to be the one with the blue. Yeah, it's a little bit of extra flair for me personally. And also that one makes me a little bit more nostalgic than the other one. That's more of the colorways that I've seen from the past.
I'd go red. I don't know. That'd be great.
Would
though.
You? We could... Oh, great. Well, then we're not clashing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. We get sort of semi-matching bikes. I believe the write-ups that have come out of the launch for this bike as well have been pretty good. I don't know if you saw the front page of MCN the other day, but they used the headline retrosexual on the front page of MCN.
Cool.
It was a bit of a surprise. Normally they play it a bit safer, I think, than that. But, you know,
got... Did it have an asterisk or a star for the sexual? No. Or was it actually spelled out?
Just a retrosexual.
Wow, commitment.
What I really like about this sticker pack, though, is the way those speed blocks on the side there, which are a signature, you know, Yamaha feature, they taper to the rear. And because the tail section is quite chunky... you know, standard, but they've left it white and then had this sort of thinning speed block on the side. I think it slims out the back end of the bike and actually makes it look overall quite a bit better looking. It's like a visual trick. Is that called a trompe d'oeil? It's a French
go
thing.
On, look trompe, it up whilst I...
trompe l'oeil. but it means like trick of the eye in artistic terms.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I like trompe l'oeil.
Yeah, I think so.
Trompe l'oeil. It's a clever one, yeah, because I think the rear end on that one, it's a bit blocky. It's a bit sort of unfinished on the sort of stock versions. Certainly on the unfed version.
It looks a bit imbalanced.
It does.
Yeah, tail heavy.
Yeah, it does. So that's where I think with the GP it does look better, because it has that, you know, the front end kind of balances it out. And then, like you say, if you do visual tricks like that as well, it makes it look even better. So yeah, it's a winner.
Fantastic looking bike, in my opinion. It's one of those where I'm like, if I had to buy something... I love the MT-09 so, so much, but it just, you know, doesn't really do it for me that much visually. I think it's quite a good looking bike, but I definitely prefer the retros. And this is like almost a dream bike for me then, because it's got most the same chassis. I think the swing arm's a bit longer, so it does feel a bit more stable perhaps. But the styling job is fantastic. And then just to have this extra kit on it, I'd almost like to see this sticker pack, but without the fairing lowers, so it looks a bit more cafe.
I really like, I think this is a really good playmate as well for the Kawasaki Z900. I think they're leaning into retro in a really cool way, and they're not trying to sort of it just feels more natural. And I suppose it is, we're phasing into a different area now, and it does mean that they're not really competing with, say, Triumph and the Bonnevilles, because they are different. So I like
sporty
it
and getting into that sort of 80s or 90s era. Yeah. Which I like as well. I love some of these colour schemes. I loved it when Honda did the anniversary Fireblades. I thought they were absolutely fantastic looking. You can probably still get one. Yeah. Did they do... What was that amazing orange... Is it Urban Tiger Honda? Yeah, Urban Tiger.
Right.
I don't know if they did a CBR 1000 RRR. I don't think they've done a modern version of that. But I think I saw someone who did their own recreation of it. And look, all those really popping sports bike colour schemes. Yeah, I love it. I love that they're making a comeback. In fact, let us know in the comments which bikes you'd like to see sort of their schemes plastered on a current day bike. I need to know the previous gen bike. This will be good for comment of the week next week. The one that you want to take inspiration from, and which bike they should slap the paint on that's in their current lineup. Anyway, a huge thanks to everybody for listening. As always, like I say, you can listen to us on your favorite podcasting apps on the audio version. But of course, you know, we like to talk about the bikes and get the visuals on the screen. So if you want to get more involved with your eyes, then go to YouTube, search for Full Tank Motorcycle Podcast, and you'll find our channel where you can watch the full episode. So yes, do leave us your comments and get involved. Again, many thanks for listening, and we'll see you in the next episode.